Again, our main event, nationalism is an important value that Americans should support. Arguing for the affirmative, Rich Lowry. Rich, please come to the stage. Arguing for the negative, Alex Narasta. Alex, please come to the stage. Jane, please close the voting. Rich, you have 15 minutes to defend the resolution. Take it away, Rich.
Thank you very much. So in debates like this, and really in any form of political argument, rhetoric, even in our daily lives, we really want people to use the correct words for things, right? To not resort to euphemism. And I'm here to tell you this will never happen. And this was brought home to me in my home life not too long ago. So my daughter learned the word stupid, which is not the worst word in the world, right? But she was quite delighted with herself. She was saying stupid all the time. It's just kind of annoying. So yeah, I said to her, you know, why don't, instead of using the word stupid, why don't you use the word ill-considered instead, right? I'm the editor-in-chief of National Review. I got to try, at least, right? So this didn't work, as you might expect. Stupid, stupid, stupid. Why don't you say ill-considered? Stupid, stupid, stupid. On it goes. So then one morning, this was around the time she was getting potty trained, and my wife would put in a pad in her pants, you know, just in case, extra insurance. She gets up one Saturday morning, goes into the bathroom, uses the toilet in a marvelous fashion, and then in an excess of zeal, throws in the pad, flushes the whole thing, it backs up, and it's a sewerish debacle in this bathroom. When things go wrong, you know, in the household, it's always blamed on me, maybe correctly, maybe not, but you know, I'm going in, I'm swabbing, I'm mopping, I'm doing the whole nine yards, and my wife's like, Rich, you gotta talk to her. She can't do this kind of thing. Rich, talk to her. Okay, I'm gonna talk to her. You know, after 20 minutes of cleaning up, I come out, and I'm ready for this fantastic daughter-father moment. I take her on my knee, and I say, honey, what did you do wrong? You said, Daddy, I did something ill-considered. So it's a pleasure to be here. I want to thank Soho Forum for putting on this event. I want to thank Alex for being here on the debate stage. I think it'll be a fun and hopefully illuminating evening. I didn't realize, by the way, that this is such a reason-oriented event. It slowly dawned on me that the link is to Reason TV, the Reason magazines on the back of the seat. So I guess I'm the conservative patsy who just walked into this libertarian trap, you know? It should have been a sign when Grant was asked to sing songs about freedom instead of songs about national feeling, you know? But I'm a huge admirer of freedom, of Reason, and freedom too, and Reason, which I think is easily the second best political magazine in the English language. So, and I also appreciate all you being here. Mark Twain said the best audiences are inquisitive, well-informed, and drunk. So I think we probably have like two out of the first three, and we'll work on the third across the street a little later. Okay, so let's talk about nationalism. So there's a common erroneous belief that patriotism is the word for everything good in national feeling, and nationalism is the word for everything bad and national feeling. And this is just a erroneous and unsustainable definition. If we get technical for a moment, the root of patriotism, the Latin word patre, it's the same root as patriarchy. It means fatherland, right? It means love of land of our fathers, love of our own. This is a natural and important sentiment. Nationalism is closely related, but is something separate. So nationalism is the doctrine or the idea that a distinct people, united by a common culture, united by a common history, united very often by a common language, should govern a distinct piece of territory. Distinct people, distinct territory. Now, this might not sound like an outlandish idea to you, for a good reason. This defines the entirety of the modern international system. This is the world we live in, is defined by nationalism, right? We live in a world where distinct peoples have their sovereign borders and their own distinct cultures. Is this a terrible thing? Is this a bad thing? No, this is a good thing. And if you agree, it's a good thing. Then, even if you didn't know it or not when you came in these doors, you are a nationalist. Congratulations. I have a book to sell to you on Amazon right now. Now, if you look at this, the system, and compare it to the rest of the human history, it's worked marvelously well. It's created more stability, it's created more international peace, and it's created more democracy. Entire books have been written about this phenomenon. Steven Pinker had a wonderful one several years ago. Now, most people would support that system, but you don't have to, right? There are alternatives to nationalism. You can say, no, our primary loyalty shouldn't be to the nation. It should be to tribe or to clan or to sect. And this is the way it was throughout most of human history and still is in many places today. Look at Afghanistan, right? There are a lot of people in Afghanistan say, no, I'm not an Afghan. I don't even know what that is. I'm a Pashtun or I'm an Azeri. And this is a very deeply felt loyalty. Obviously, as we've learned to our regret, they'll defend it very ferociously, but it makes it impossible to have a coherent nation state in Afghanistan. And just like Afghanistan, makes it impossible to have a coherent nation state. And just like Afghanistan, many failed states around the world lack this kind of requisite nationalism to make it work. And even in this country, a tiny fringe of a fringe, there are people who want to elevate a tribal loyalty above the nation, right? The morons who were marching with the tiki torches in Charlottesville want to elevate race over the American nation, which they think has been a terrible deal and an awful mistake. January 6th, you look at that. If your reaction to that is, you know what, that Capitol is ours. It belongs to all of us. You know that box they bring out when they're counting the electoral votes? They've done it for 200 years. How dare you? How dare you interrupt that? And how dare you disgrace us before the world? That's, at bottom, that's a nationalist sentiment. There are all sorts of other reasons to oppose those people, but that is a nationalist sentiment. So maybe you don't want to be a nationalist or a tribalist. Well, there are other alternatives. There have been great empires throughout human history, many quite long-lasting. The Ottomans, right? The Habsburgs, the Russians, right? These empires had many things to recommend them, but they were not one of them was a democracy, and they depended on coercion to hold themselves together because they had captive peoples, captive nations who didn't want to be governed by the center represented by another people or nation. They wanted to govern themselves, and as soon as the coercion gave way, these empires split up. Now, if we want to take this in the current context, again, you don't have to be a nationalist. You can look at the conflict between Russia, where Vladimir Putin is a neo-imperialist bent on restoring as much of the Russian empire as he can, or you can be with the Ukrainians, right? You can be with Zelensky and the Ukrainians who are involved in a classic people's struggle to defend their land, to defend their sovereignty, to defend their culture. And I submit to you, those aren't bad things. Those aren't small-minded things. Those are things that are crucial to every people in the world, and what they are doing is hugely admirable. Again, you're not a nationalist, you can root for the British colonial empire against Gandhi. You're not a nationalist, you can vote for Napoleon and imperial project against the European countries that resisted him in war after war in the Napoleonic era. You're not a nationalist, you can be a sympathizer of the Soviet Union and not Lech Walesa and other nationalists in Eastern Europe who wanted their countries, their nations, to be free. Now let's bring it around to the United States really quickly and just look at the history of nationalism in this country. The American Revolution was a nationalist revolution. The Americans said, we've lived here in these shores now for 130 years, whatever it is. We've taken on a distinct identity of our own, and we should be allowed to govern ourselves. Just a classic lowest common denominator nationalist sentiment. Now, not everyone agreed with them, right? The country, according to John Adams, divided in thirds, a third Tories, a third Patriots, third in between. And the Tories thought, no, we'll still be loyal to the crown, this other political authority across the ocean. But the nationalists, I submit to you, were right. After the war, given their experience of dealing with the Continental Congress during the war. And afterwards, Washington and Hamilton said, you know what? We need a national government worthy of the name, or this project is going to fail and bring discredit to democracy evermore. We have to make it work. There's a constitutional convention. The Constitution is drafted, and the nationalists make the case for adopting it. The anti-federalists, honorable people, sincere people, passionate people, intelligent people. The Library of America collected their writings not too long ago. They're worth reading. But they were wrong. The nationalists were right. We needed a constitution, which has become the sheetrock of our sovereignty going forward. And then, of course, the Civil War. We have the Southern fire eaters believing, no, there was not really a national compact that had to be adhered to. The national government was a threat to slavery, and they had to go their own way. And Lincoln and his allies were right that this insurrection had to be crushed. So this, all this is to say, if you go through American history, whether it's Washington, Hamilton, whether it's John Quincy Adams, Lincoln, T.R., they largely had it right. Even FDR, obviously, I don't support his economic policies, but it was his international vision that's created this world of nation states that I've been describing. Now, American nationalism has, from the beginning, been more liberal than other versions of nationalism around the world. I mean, liberal, obviously, in the classical liberal sense. And a lot of scholars believe that what American nationalism is what they call civic nationalism, right? This is the belief that the foundations of our nationalism are shared citizenship, devotion to our civic ideals, and loyalty to our institutions. This is, again, a very basic nationalism. But at the very least, everyone should support that. And if you support that, you are a nationalist. Now, I'd submit to you, cultural nationalism is also very important. And let me illustrate what I mean by that. Just hypothetically, let's say on the steps of the Paris Opera House tonight, a European-American meets an African-American. Might be from different regions of the country, might have different politics, but they instantly have more in common than anyone else around them. They speak the same language, so that they can be assured that they understand one another. They wear the same kind of clothes, broadly. They like the same kind of food, and they have, even if they don't recognize it, this enormous store of shared cultural knowledge, whether it's from, you know, what Britney Spears is posting on Instagram right now, or whether it's who won the Super Bowl last year, or whether it's phrases that, even if they, again, they're not aware of it, that go back to the King James Bible, which is the most important book for so long in our early history. So again, is this a bad thing? It's a good thing. It should be fostered and protected. It lends a cultural coherence to this country. It gives us social trust, which is so important for the market, the free market to work, for democracy to work. And again, places like Afghanistan that don't have this do not have democracies. If they don't have this basic level of coherence and social trust, they get civil wars, they get coups, they get ethnic cleansing. So we need these pillars of commonality. Yes, nationalism can be abused. Everything that's natural and powerful can be abused. Love can be abused, right? Love's a wonderful thing. It can become possessiveness and even violence, the opposite of love. So it needs to be true love and carefully defined and have guardrails. Christianity, I'm a Christian. Just, there are many, many examples of this, but just look at the Crusades and the enormities that were committed in the name of my God. Does that mean I shouldn't be a Christian? No. It means that we should have a properly defined Christianity. So, in short, turning our back on the very basic and unobjectionable and necessary things that hold us together, especially at a time of great political contention and division, based on a hostile misunderstanding of the idea of nationalism, would be, to say the least, ill-considered. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much to Soho Forum, to Gene Epstein for putting this together, to Reason for co-hosting, for Nick for his great introduction, and for Rich for being here today. Now, there are many books on nationalism. I put those books into three broad categories. The first are informative but dry and descriptive academic tomes. The second are breezy, easy to read, and bad works of ahistorical propaganda. The third group of books are well-written, informative, and support nationalism. I put Rich's book in the third category. Indeed, if you want to read the best case for nationalism in book form, I suggest that you pick up Rich's book. However, that does not mean that I agree with it. Rich advocates for a benign nationalism that doesn't exist in the real world. Rich's nationalism is theoretical and bears almost no relationship to nationalism as it actually exists. Real nationalism as it exists in the world is often and mostly a primitive, statist, protectionist, anti-capitalist, frequently, not often, of course, xenophobic, and often ethnocentric proto-ideology of, quote, my tribe best, your tribe bad, unquote, with the tribe being the core of the ideology. The only individual who counts is the chief of the tribe. It's an ideology of group rights that denigrates individualism in favor of an abstraction known as a tribe, or in this case, the nation. And by nation, I mean a literal tribe of genetically similar individuals with a common language, culture, religion, and ethnicity. This is why the Latin root of the word nationalism is natio, which means birth, ethnicity, race of people, tribe, or other group of related people or things. Now, I like that Rich separates his benign version of nationalism from the jingoistic and more nasty variety. But nationalism almost always, not 100% of the time, but almost always veers in this nasty, jingoistic statist direction, which is exactly the variety we see popular amongst most American and foreign nationalists today and in the past. Rich is not this type of nationalist. If all nationalists were like Rich, we wouldn't be having this debate today. But the difference between Rich's nationalism and nationalism as it actually exists is why we're here. The great failure of Rich's project is that he builds a nicer, theoretical version of nationalism and does not deal with nationalism as it actually exists in the world and in the minds of nationalists. Nationalism is the ideology that paves the right-wing road to serfdom. Unlike other opponents of nationalism, I am going to concede a point up front to Rich. Nationalism is an ancient proto-ideology that is likely hardwired into our DNA to some extent. It's primordial. Nationalism was not invented in Europe shortly after the printing press, and it is not a modern ideology. Nationalism can't be erased any more than any other aspects of human nature could be erased, and we should not try. Nationalism has a weaker hold on humans than other parts of our biology, such as love for one's children, which is why nations must coerce their citizens to contribute to other nationals and the state through taxation, conscription, forced labor or forced attendance in government schools, while few people have to be coerced to care for their children. What we should do is build and reinforce institutional and cultural walls around nationalism to limit its destructive impact. And this is one reason why the United States is an exceptional country. Our ancestors built walls around nationalism and constrained its ability to ruin this great country. Constitutional limitations that reduce the power of majorities and the dedication to individual rights, not group rights or national rights, were inspired by an ideology of classical liberalism, not an appeal to an eternal myth of a nation. That's because the United States is not a nation represented by a state. It's not a nation state, has never been a nation state, can never be a nation state. The founding documents of this country did not create a nation state, and the founders could not have done so even if they wanted to. The United States was born a country with an ideological underpinning, a creedal country with civic identity, as academics say, not a national one bound by ties of blood or a near-uniform, centrally planned culture like many of the nations in Europe. The United States has a creed, or broad enlightenment, classical liberal ideology, adherence to certain principles with a few cultural characteristics and broad commonality. We're not unique in this respect. Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and others are similar. But the U.S. takes it the furthest. Other countries, particularly those in Europe and some in Asia, are founded as nation states, where the states represent a traditionally settled tribal or ethnic group. The United States was founded in ideology. Nation states are founded in ideas of blood, borders, and centrally managed culture. Regardless of the theoretical definitions of nationalism that we've heard, we must deal with empirical, real-world nationalism and judge its effects. We can't judge an ideology by the intentions of its advocates. We rightly judge communism by its awful real-world effects and mock communists who say the disasters of communism aren't the result of real communism. We should do the same to nationalists who claim that the awful real-world effects of nationalism aren't real nationalism. I'm going to highlight six common real-world effects of nationalism that are major downsides from the perspectives of American traditional conservatives and libertarians. Then you can compare those downsides to the benefits that Rich described to see if nationalism is worth it. Now, just to repeat, I'm not arguing that Rich supports all of these effects, but these are the common and sometimes unintentional effects of nationalism. We have to judge nationalism by its effects, not by the intentions of its well-intended and moderate advocates like Rich. The first downside of nationalism is that it increases centralized state power. In nationalism, the state representing a nation, known as a nation state, is the only organization that counts because it represents the entire nation. Individualism is not important, individual rights don't matter, and a nation's government does and should determine everything regardless of the desires of the centers. National decisions are made by the state. This is especially true in times of distress, when nationalists claim to, quote, rediscover the essence of the nation, unquote, and seek to control its embodiment, the state, as the only real source of value and a refuge in times of desperation. The second effect of nationalism is that it tends to concentrate state power in a single person, the leader. Nationalists often conflate the nation with that of an individual political leader who is a nationalist, frequently a strongman, sometimes a dictator, and other times a king, probably because the nation is just an abstraction that requires a totem of some kind to be real in the minds of men. This is why Schopenhauer described monarchy as a natural force. It's also why other large non-state organizations today are often strongly identified with the person leading them, Twitter, Elon Musk, for example. A charismatic, strong leader who stands above, quote, petty, unquote, individual distinctions, and who represents strength, who requires more power, who disregards small concerns like individual liberty, who builds a cult of personality, and who is the representative of the nation, fits the bill. And we see this again and again in nationalist governments throughout history and across the world today. The third common effect of nationalism is more state control over the economy. After all, the nation knows best, and its government will do whatever it thinks is in the national interest, or, you know, more accurately, whatever is in the best interest of nationalist politicians. It's no mistake that national conservatives, as they call themselves today in the United States, favor industrial policy, protectionism, high taxes, closed borders, pro-union policies, a large welfare state, praise the New Deal even, and desire more state control over the economy. Increasing state control of the economy is partly ideological and partly just a byproduct of the increasingly centralized state that nationalists demand. We see it with economic protectionism like tariffs on foreign products, such as steel for vague national defense reasons, or making sure all baby formula is made in the United States with disastrous consequences. This is the same today as it was in the heyday of nationalism from the late 19th century to World War II. The fourth effect of nationalism is more government control over the private lives of citizens and central planning of culture. From the French Revolution originating the term nation building in France and the central planning of language to Vladimir Putin in Russia and dozens of nationalist leaders in between, they all use the state to force the preferred version of a centrally planned culture on society. The most common vehicle for this is through state education system that instills nationalist values, imposes uniform language or linguistic guidelines, and subsidizes certain cultural norms over others. The powerful nation-state canon does impose different values, and dissenters be damned. The fifth effect of nationalism is the glorification of militarism, war, and lesser hostility between nations through trade wars, tearing up of arms control treaties for no good reason. Judged by the numbers of deaths caused by different types of governments in the 20th century, just focusing on governments murdering their own citizens, nationalism is second only to communism. And that excludes the nationalist crimes against humanity during the age of imperialism, whereby nationalists murdered over 50 million people, according to historian R.J. Rummel. As historian Douglas Porch noted, quote, colonialism was not, as Lenin claimed, the highest stage of capitalism. Rather, it was the highest stage of nationalism. We see nationalist wars more vividly today in Russia's attempt to conquer Ukraine as part of a nationalist irredentism to reconstitute the Russian Empire by bringing the, quote, fake ethnicity of Ukrainians, unquote, back into the Russian fold, as Russian nationalists say. It's no mistake that so many nationalists around the world admired Putin prior to his invasion, such as Dutch nationalist Thierry Baudet, French nationalist Marine Le Pen, Italian nationalist and Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, and former Italian Prime Minister Berlusconi, who still defends Putin after the invasion. and many American national conservatives, as they call themselves. Some American national conservatives and NatCons slobbered over Putin in part because his military recruitment advertisements showed Russians as extremely manly. Now, in his book, Rich praises Teddy Roosevelt as an American nationalist, a man whose greatest accomplishments were support for the income tax, burdening successful American firms with mountains of red tape, trust busting, building a large obsolete navy, creating new bureaucracies, creating national parks, and advocating for U.S. entry into just about every war going on around the globe, and accomplishing many feats of great physical strength. Now, as a libertarian, none of those nationalist so-called achievements thrill me, and they shouldn't thrill the traditional conservatives listening today. The sixth common effect of nationalism is ethnic chauvinism, and to a disturbingly frequent extent, genocide. Slaughters in nationalist Turkey, mass death in nationalist China, two world wars were caused by nationalists with revanchist dreams. Historian Aristide Zolberg went as far as to call the formation of new nation states as, quote, a refugee-generating process, unquote, to expel groups of people who are not members of the new nation. Not every nationalist government commits genocide or engages in ethnic chauvinism, but not every communist regime causes a great famine either. We shouldn't give nationalists a pass any more than we should give communists a pass. Still, we should be extremely skeptical and oppose communist governments everywhere for this and other reasons, just as we should be extremely skeptical and oppose nationalist governments. With such a large potential downside to nationalism, the benefits must be greater to justify adopting such an ideology. What are the upsides? We've heard about feelings of belonging that will lead to national greatness. That payoff, mainly in the form of magic words, does not justify the potential downsides. They're the equivalent of asking a person to risk their life, freedom, material possessions today for abstract feelings in the future that probably won't arrive. Do you feel better and more connected to other American strangers when Donald Trump, who embraced nationalism as president? Did Trump cause American solidarity to increase? Just the opposite. Nationalism is a schismatic ideology that pulls citizens apart from one another instead of binding them together. Meaning and belonging come from family, friendships, real communities of people who know each other, hobbies, career, and other personal relationships, not from devotion to a national abstraction. Some of you may be thinking that the six common effects of nationalism sound a lot like those of communism. You'd be correct. Those downsides are also not unique to nationalism or communism, but nationalism seems to make a virtue out of these downsides and gives a legitimate patina to them. At the very least, nationalism doesn't even acknowledge the downside risks. Nationalism is to the right wing what communism is to the left wing. Poorly reasoned utopianism that often leads to some of the worst crimes against humanity. Communism promised material prosperity and equality for all and failed dramatically. What does nationalism promise but some good feelings or meaning tied to an abstraction? In an ideologically founded country like the U.S., nationalism is a disuniting force and not a uniting one. Nationalism here builds walls around different groups and defines political opponents or other groups as less American than others. Nationalism is an exclusionary ideology, not an inclusive one. Nationalism often defines a country in terms of what it's not, usually foreigners. But that frame is easily applied to defining fellow American citizens as not real nationalists either. Claremont Senior Fellow Glenn Elmers, an American nationalist and writer at a nationalist publication, wrote in 2021 that the 80 million Americans who voted for President Joe Biden in 2020 were, quote, not Americans in any meaningful sense of the term, unquote. And Claremont's Charles R. Kessler has argued that the U.S. is experiencing a cold civil war. These nationalists believe that half of American voters have betrayed the nation. They obviously don't care about building national solidarity. If they wanted to build national solidarity and harness good feelings for national greatness, they would be trying to bring the country together instead of trying to label half of their fellow countrymen as non-Americans or un-American. Where is this benign nationalism and uniting nationalism that Rich speaks of? Certainly not in the minds or on the lips of nationalists. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Five minutes of rebuttal, Rich Lowry.
Thank you. Thank you, Alex. That was forceful and comprehensive, so I'm not going to be able to get to everything. But first of all, I can't answer for everything that any idiot says on the internet or any other publication, or nor am I responsible for anything that a certain former president of the United States might say. So the contention, the United States is not a nation state, And this is really breaking news. Should we not be in the United Nations? Are we falsely listed among the 150, whatever it is, nations at the United Nations? Why do we have borders if we're not a nation state? Why do we have a military? What's a military doing? How does an ideal have and build a military and deploy a military as possible? I got to try to wrap my head around that one. We have trade policy. We have rules around citizenship. We have political traditions that are written down. All these are constituent parts of a nation. So I think Alex's argument fails at that most basic level, because if he acknowledges we're a nation state, then he has to acknowledge, well, we should feel some loyalty to this nation state and to its traditions. And guess what? That's civic nationalism. We're all nationalists. So he has to engage in a really reality-defying act of rhetorical gymnastics to say we're not a nation state. And then, you know, that nationalism's inherently centralizing. Well, yes, no. I just think saying that proves too much. Again, without sort of the comprehensive way that Alex feels necessary to make his case, I think for understandable rhetorical reasons, would mean he'd oppose the adoption of the Constitution. That was a hugely centralizing event to have a Constitution. Again, the Anti-Federalists, they opposed it for that reason. So this is the charter of our liberties, the charter of our sovereignty, the basics of our civic nationalism. Alex would oppose it if he's true to his premises. Again, I think he has to go this extreme because he knows he'd otherwise have to give too much away. The Civil War, right? Hugely centralizing event. Hugely. I mean, there are some libertarians who actually, they don't like Lincoln because he was a centralizer. Because he's like, actually, no, we do have a national compact that cannot be broken, and the national government has integrity and legitimacy. I think those things are obviously true. Now, it doesn't mean you have to go to the excesses that progressives do. I think the Constitution means something and should limit the central government in important ways. But it does establish a central government of a nation state. And then so if nation states are so terrible, like they're inherently illiberal and they are going to automatically murder all their citizens, you know, one group's going to murder another, what's the alternative? I mean, look at England. So in the Middle Ages, you had all these little kingdoms, mini kingdoms. You had, you know, Wessex and Mercia and Northumbria, these kind of interesting places to read about. Was this better for England? Was this better for freedom, for peace, for the market, to have it all divided up? Of course not. They're waging war on each other constantly. And it was good for freedom, it was good for liberalism that you got a nation state, a true nation state in England. And in fact, in the 19th century, Alex, again, he wants to portray all nationalists. They want to kill people. The nationalists in the 19th century were liberals. They opposed the empires that were repressing. They believe deeply in equality of citizenship. These are honored people, Manzini and Masaryk. To believe they're monsters is completely, it just makes no sense whatsoever. And again, if you take his premises seriously, let's reconstitute all the empires so we can get rid of these nation states. Get them back into the Soviet Union. Get them back into the Ottoman Empire. Maybe Napoleon should have established an empire and just held Europe under its way. And then I'm running out of time. He's gotten me started, folks. So this idea that militarism and warfare started because of nation states and nationalists, it's completely ahistorical. You know, the research goes back. There's some people who think, tribes, they just sat around, they shared, they were so nice to each other. No, like 30% of the young adults die by acts of violence. Empires, look at the Roman Empire. Some people have an idealist version of the Roman Empire, where, you know, we like the speeches and the togas. It was a military state. It crushed people and then brought them in. That's what it did. And it was an empire. It wasn't a nation state. The constituent peoples eventually wanted to be free. It was really messy when they got free. It took a while to get what we live in again. A world largely defined, there are exceptions, they're terrible, I oppose them, largely defined by sovereign nations that have sovereign borders, that have equality of citizenship, and believe, this was the key insight, going back to the founders. Governments belong to nations, not the other way around. Nations belong to the people. That's a key nationalist insight. And then finally, again, Alex should oppose the nationalists in Ukraine. He should oppose them. What are they doing? Defending their land, defending their sovereignty. What small-minded people, what right do they have to just defend a nation state?
Alex, you get, thank you, Rich. Alex, you get an extra minute and a half.
Okay.
Rich took an extra minute and a half. Well, it was a minute and a half, Rich.
The phrase nation state is pretty weird sounding, isn't it? Right? When you first heard it, it sounds pretty redundant, doesn't it, to American ears? Well, it's not redundant in Europe. It actually means something very specific. It is a state founded to represent a specific ethnicity, a specific tribe and group of people. You notice how Rich defined the term patriotism and went to the Latin root of patriotism, Father? Why didn't he do that for nationalism? Because the Latin root of nationalism is natio, which means ethnicity. In Europe, this is clear. Everybody knows about this. It's obvious over there. It's only in America where nationalists can pretend that it has nothing to do with that, or it's separate from that. The U.S. is a country, obviously. It is a state, obviously. Like lots of other countries around the world and throughout history that are not nation states, but are well-functioning, well-governed, free, and prosperous. Like Canada, Switzerland, Australia, New Zealand, and these other places that are not nation states. The United States was not founded to represent a particular ethnicity. It was not founded for that unless you believe the 1619 Project nonsense about that. It was not founded for that. The United States is different. We are founded on an ideological backdrop based on universal values. The Declaration of Independence does not say, it doesn't use the word nation. It establishes a new government. It establishes and separates from another government. The U.S. Constitution only uses the term nation twice to represent something called the Law of Nations, which is international law, how they'll enforce international law, and how they'll have relationships with foreign nations. It doesn't describe itself in that at all. We talked about nationalism and all of the good outcomes. Well, we got to take all the bad outcomes with it. Now, obviously, modern nationalists didn't invent war, but nationalism is an ancient ideology. It goes back very far. We both agree on that point. Alternatives that Rich mentioned, tribes, clans, empires, that he said are coercive. Well, the news is all states are coercive. All states are coercive. Nation states use coercion all the time. They use it for conscription, for taxation, and everything like that. It's not like nation states are everybody holding hands with the same feelings about stuff, going together in total solidarity. That's like nonsense. Nobody like that. You get three people together, they can't agree on anything. And just because we all come from the same background, we're supposed to be going forward without coercion. If that were the case, why does any nation state have an income tax? They should just pay their money out of solidarity with their fellow nationals to support all these great magic words that are out there. The alternative to nation states is not tribes or clans or Afghanistan, but a country like the United States, which is not a nation state. It is a country, it is a state, it has traditions, but it is not a nation state in the definition of it. Rich, in his book, cites frequently some of the great nationalist scholars like Anthony Smith to try to prove the point that nationalism is about culture. Of course, Anthony Smith's great book is called The Ethnic Origin of Nations. That's what it's about. That is what these people agree on. That's the Latin root of it. The Anti-Federalists created the Bill of Rights. They inserted that into the Constitution because they were concerned about individual liberties when there was a debate about the Constitution. I think the Constitution has worked out well. I think the part that has worked out the best is the part that was instituted by the Anti-Federalists. When we talk about, when Rich mentioned a lot of the nationalist politicians in American history admirers, like T.R., Lincoln, FDR, he left Woodrow Wilson off the list. Probably arguably the most nationalist American president ever. Got us involved in World War I. Created nationalist programs to try to assimilate immigrants to some kind of like special centrally planned ordeal that didn't work. Lauded by nationalists at the time. Supported all of the major progressive policies just about that Teddy Roosevelt supported. They disagreed about the League of Nations, but that's about it. What's interesting is this denigration of civic nationalism. If you want to talk about how we have something in common, civic national, by the way, is just like oxymoronic phrase, doesn't really make any sense. We have a civic identity in this country, we have an ideological identity, and that's good enough. We don't need big words that come from Europe about trying to bind us all together in some kind of mythical, made-up ethnic past to make us a successful country. Rich is right. Almost anything can be bad. Love can be bad, right? It can lead to bad things. We call that abuse. We call that stalking. Nationalism is the stalking, is to stalking what patriotism is to love. Thank you.
Thanks to you both. We get to the Q&A portion of the evening, and there is a mic for you to line up to. You guys can ask each other a question at any time during the Q&A. You maybe want to wait for the audience to ask questions before you do, but you can exercise that option now. Do either of you want to ask the other a question at this point, or do you want to wait for a bit? Looks like you want to wait. I want to take moderator's prerogative to ask each a question. Alex, you are saying that, I take it, that the word nationalism is should be expunged from your vocabulary, or put it in terms of question. The sort of thing that Rich talks about, which is an identification with the tradition of the Constitution, identification with the tradition of the Founding Fathers, identification with the spirit of the American Revolution, with all that you perhaps as a libertarian might value in the American tradition. You value it, it matters to you, so you and I are Americans. But are you saying that none of that should mean that you're introducing the word nationalism? It's out of your vocabulary altogether?
Nationalism is out of my vocabulary. I love the American founding. I think the Constitution is great, the Declaration, but these are not the behaviors of a nation state or nationalism. I'm a patriotic American. I love my country. I love it because it's lovable. I love it not because I was born here or I'm an American. If I was born somewhere else, I'd want to come here. I love the principles of it. Those are the things that make us, I think, unique. Otherwise, we're just like every other every other sort of nation state in Europe, and we're not like that. We couldn't be like that. At the time of the 1790, only 60% of people living in the United States were of English descent. Another 20% were various Europeans, another 20% were black Africans. What is the natio? What is that group that was being founded that was nationalist? There were Americans, but they were not bound together in a nation in any meaningful sense of the term, certainly not what the Latin root of the term means.
You refer to kind of how exclusionary nationalism is. So let's look at a couple American national symbols and heroes. I'm just curious whether you consider them exclusionary. The American flag, is that exclusionary? The Pledge of Allegiance, a statement of basic American creed, is that exclusionary? Our greatest national hero, George Washington, is he exclusionary?
No.
Thank you.
Okay. Question.
You could also just call them American instead of national. Right?
America is a nation, and this is another thing I'm curious. So, is it the term that trips you up that you're being very specific about nation state, or you actually think we're not a nation, like not a country, like not a nation, not a country?
Country and nation aren't the same meaning. Why did you have the? Why did you go to the Latin root for the word patriotism, but not for nationalism, to make your definition early on?
So, first of all, you're saying nation and country are different things. I've never heard this before.
Yeah, that's because you need to talk to more Europeans who understand the distinction. That's why it's oddly redundant in America to say nation state. It trips people up. They're like, why are you saying the same word twice? Because to Americans, it means the same thing. But you go to Europe, you talk to people overseas, nation state means a state founded for a particular ethnicity and tribe to represent them.
But see, so you're saying because...
So we're a country.
So you're saying because in Europe there was more of an ethnic basis to the founding of nations. We can't be a nation because we are a more open nation. I mean, we're just, we have a different iteration of our nationalism, which is one thing that makes it good, right? It's not bad because it's different. That's a good thing about it. And you're playing a definitional game to try to deny that obviously we're a nation because you fear if we have, we're a nation, we have national symbols and national heroes. No, they have to be American. Don't use the word nation or nationalism. You're playing a word game to try to support your point.
It's what the word means. Okay. Why can't you just say patriotism? Why can't you just say that we're not bound together by this mystical nonsense? We're bound together by a civic ethos.
No, George Washington is real. He's a national hero. He's a source of coherence. He's a unifying figure. Now, I think you inherently find that, well, it's bad.
Something no, that we're, I don't we're think all, George
all,
Washington...
We all believe in. We can't have that.
Okay, no,
but he is a national hero. He's not a country hero.
I don't think that heroes are bad, but the word nation means something specific, which is why it is so often tied up in people's minds with brutality, with genocide, with war, with ethnic exclusion, with all these things. You write about this in your book,
were democratic nationalists.
Okay, let me have
De Gaulle,
Rich.
And Churchill and FDR.
Rich, you have the last word on that. I have a question for you, Rich, in particular. One of the things that bothers me as an economist is that I'm picking up on something that Alex mentioned, which you didn't get a chance to respond to specifically, which is that that the nationalist viewpoint does seem to lead inevitably into a disturbing tendency on the part of many conservatives, probably and hopefully not you, to impose protectionism.
Yeah.
You're appealing, and it's so such an easy sell to so many Americans. You're nodding, so I needn't elaborate. How do you react to
yeah,
that
no,
problem?
I agree. Look, it's not. I don't agree with everyone on the center right. Right. I agree with Alex probably on like 80% of stuff, but obviously we disagree on 20. And the same thing with a lot of people who call themselves nationalists. My test is kind of the nationalist test for policy. Is it in America's interest? Okay, that should be the first test. Alex has an entirely different view of immigration policy than I do. I assume he thinks it's in America's interest. Everything I've read, that's kind of a nationalist test. Is it good for the country, the nation? And I think these people, they believe, I think rightly, that there was an overemphasis on just, oh, it's free trade, it's got to be by definition good. I mean, maybe some people in the room agree with that, but it's to be subjected to this test. Is it really in our interest? Is it serving our interests, particularly trade arrangements with China? If the answer is no, then I don't support a free trade approach in that regard. If the answer is yes, I'd support free trade, and I mostly do. But the test is it does it serve our interests? Does it serve the interests of our people?
Just to be fair, you know, if it shuts down factories in certain areas of the country, but then it leads to better deal for American consumers, that's a kind of a trade-off, then who is we at this point? Because some people are losing their jobs and feeling intense pain, and they have to move to get better jobs. So how do we know whether it's in our interest?
Yeah, I mean, these are prudential questions, but
okay.
If it serves the overall interest of the country,
okay.
I think that, and there's pain, I mean, that's terrible. You might want to do things to mitigate it, or you might just consider it inevitable. I mean, this is where I disagree with the NatCons. It's just not the case that there's been totally equal economic progress across every industry and every geographic location in the United States. And that's your standard. You're gonna kill economic dynamism and growth. Just really quickly, I was cleaning out my mom's house when she was moving to assisted living. I found these. These old letters from my great-grandfather, who turns out was the editor of a Republican newspaper, so I guess it runs in the genes somehow. But I found all these letters he was writing to my grandfather. Automobiles are terrible, son. They're the worst thing. All they do is kill people. They're disgusting. Why won't they go away? And I asked him, why is he so anti-car? And she said, well, he owned the hotel at the rail depot. You know, and the highway came and bypassed it, so of course he hated cars. But if you give in to that sentiment, he was hurt by that economic advance, but obviously cars and highways were good for the country's overall interest.
Thank comment from you, Alex, and then
the overwhelming feeling amongst national conservatives and nationalists is to follow the economic policies of Woodrow Wilson and FDR. We see this again and again with the NatCons. We see it with Sir Robert Murray, right? What was his phrase? I'm a pro-life New Dealer and that kind of nonsense. I mean, if you had told me like 10 years ago that the most advanced guard of energetic conservatives who support Trump and J.D. Vance and Blake Masters and all these other NatCons and nationalist politicians on the right are a bunch of New Deal lovers, like, I would have told you, oh, that's crazy. Like, if you put that into a movie, I'd have to walk out of the theater because it's so ridiculous. But here we are. There is something about a group and ideology that wants to concentrate state power in an individual or in a political party or in some kind of mystical ideal that pushes many of them to support state control over the economy. And that's what we see. You want to take a look at what nationalists are going to do or try to do when they get power in the United States? You know, look at Woodrow Wilson or FDR. It's a pretty good game plan.
Question from the audience now. Please ask your question as a question and address it to whomever you would like if it is going to be addressed to a particular person on stage.
My question is addressed to both. When does a country or a nation cross the line into an empire, and do you think the United States crossed that line?
Sounds like it's addressed to Alex more, but so Alex, want to take it first?
So Rich and I disagree about what a nation means. So I would say that the U.S. certainly has something close to an empire with its military bases and foreign intervention and massive numbers of wars, failed wars, mostly started by nationalists over the course of the 20th and early 21st century. So I think you can make that argument that the United States certainly has a large presence around the world and an inordinate amount of power. But of course, this was pushed by a lot of nationalist politicians. It's this notion that you can't be a nationalist if you support aggressive wars against other nations is like ludicrous. Like, that's ludicrous. Of course they do all the time. What happens when two nations disagree with each other over something? Well, oftentimes they go to war. Does that mean they're not nationalists anymore? Of course they are. They disagree.
So you stop being a nationalist when you stop being concerned with governing yourselves and you want to go govern someone else. And this can be a legitimately fuzzy area, but Napoleon was not a nationalist. Hitler was not a nationalist, right? they wanted an empire. They wanted a European-wide empire. So that, you know, in between the extremes, you can argue about the middle, but those are clearly imperial projects. Now, the United States, and this was a failing of ours, you know, we tended that way in the late 19th and early 20th century. Philippines, a prime example. You know, I think if you look where we are now, these bases, they're desired by these countries. You know, if you're Japan or Taiwan or anyone on the perimeter of China, which has historically had empire after empire, wants to restore an empire just the way Vladimir Putin does, they want us there. It's not like we have a gun to their head, please let us station troops there. They want us there because we will, they trust us, we'll see, they trust us to defend their national sovereignty when it's under threat from a political entity that has zero respect for it.
I'm kind of hung up on the whole Hitler wasn't a nationalist thing.
Okay.
The head of the National Socialist German Workers' Party, because he wanted to conquer some neighbors? I mean, does that mean because France conquered Africa in the 19th century, they weren't a nation state all of a sudden?
No, I mean, that was not a nationalist project.
Why not?
Conquering other countries is not, or other repressing other people is not a nationalist. It's a colonial. I think you used the word colonial. That's appropriate. You got the definition right on that one. And if you say, you know what, I think there is there's a superior race that should ethnically cleanse all of Europe and mass murder the Jews and be led by a charismatic madman, that doesn't make you a nationalist. It makes you a Nazi, right? There's a huge difference. What and I think this is what you kind of think. Mazzini, you know, who wanted Italian freedom and Italian unity, must have been a kind of Nazi. You know, Lech Walesa, who wanted freedom for Poland, he must have been kind of a Nazi. You can't trust him. He's a nationalist. There clearly, we can make reasonable distinctions. And when you're conquering all of Europe, that is no longer a national project. And just last point, Nazism has nothing to do with like the great nationalists in the American tradition, like Alexander Hamilton, right? Was Alexander Hamilton a proto-fascist? It's absurd.
Just one more thing. The first line, let me see if I can find it. I did think of this, but I know of no serious historian of the Third Reich or other thinkers on nationalism who would go that far. The first point of the political platform of the National Socialists was, quote, "We demand the unification of all Germans in the Greater Germany on the basis of people's right to self-determination." Listen, they were not all nationalists or Nazis.
So they held true. That's what Nazism was? They just wanted self-determination for the Germans? That's why they murdered 6 million Jews?
There's
an added element that's not nationalist. Think mass murdering Jews is inherently a nationalistic project?
No, but I'm saying that to say that Hitler was not a nationalist is like when communists say Stalin was not a communist just because they don't like what he did.
Changing the definition. Conquering other countries by definition is not nationalism. Imperialism? How do you define imperialism?
Imperialism is the highest stage of nationalism.
You find a distinction between
imperialism
nations.
Is the highest stage of nationalism.
No, it's not.
As Douglas Porch said.
No, it's not.
I think we see the disagreement here.
So were there no nations within the Soviet Union?
Guys.
The Soviet Union was just a nation?
Guys, okay, just a moment.
The Soviet Union was just a nation.
Was France not a nation state when it conquered a bunch of countries?
That was not a national project.
I think we understand the difference between you guys on this issue. Next question.
So thank you both for a spirited debate right now.
Just get to your question, sir.
Sorry. Yeah. So my question's for Alex. So one of your major arguments is that nationalism is both centralizing and an anti-democratic ruler. How do you reconcile that with the real-world historical fact that many nationalist movements are decentralizing? Take historically, like the Habsburg Empire, or today, Catalonian nationalism.
Oh, decentralizing. I think that question is addressed to you, Rich, more than others. Why don't you take it first?
How do I distinguish between?
I think I understood the question. Of course, there are many more nation states than there were decades ago, and therefore nationalism is decentralizing.
We could have a world of empires. We could have the Soviet Union again. I guess that would be safer because it wouldn't be nationalist, right? Or we could have the Ottoman Empire, we could have the Russian Empire, we could have a huge Chinese empire. Those are inherently repressive enterprises. So the nationalist ideal is when you have a separate people and their arguments over what a people is and what the border should be. But once you have that, they should govern themselves. And everyone feels this way, right? We would not enjoy having like a North American empire governed from Ottawa, right? Where we no longer have the say in how we govern ourselves. We'd all feel that as a grave offense. Now, Alex will say, oh, that's just Canadian nationalism. It's not. It would be North American imperialism and would be a bad thing. People should govern themselves. Hitler aside, the nationalists in the 19th century, the nationalists in the American tradition were concerned with self-government, equal citizenship. These were not ideas that the great imperial projects and empires came up with. They're ideas that nationalists came up with. And again, Alex has to go so extreme because he can't acknowledge like anything good about any aspects of nations or nationalism, because then he gives away the basic point that there's civic, at very least, there's civic nationalism in this country that we should all feel a sense of attachment to.
I like patriotism. I'm patriotic. I think that's a perfectly good word that doesn't have all that baggage or extra meaning.
See, then you're just playing a word game. You're saying, oh, so Rich calls it civic nationalism. I call it patriotism, so then it's okay. But it's the same thing.
It's not the same thing.
You're playing
civic nationalism
about
is an
what a nation
phrase.
And a country is and what nationalism
is. I also think, by the way, empires are bad, even when nationalists create them, which they mostly do and try to.
Next question.
Mostly for Alex, do you think the identity politics of the left pose a threat to the national fabric and build a case for the somewhat unifying effect of a national identity?
So I don't like the wokeism and all that sort of nonsense. I think they are inspired by nationalists, by trying to create new identities based on ethnic and racial and other sorts of silly sort of build walls around to say some people are better than other people, they're better in these different ways, we're going to have our special governance and benefits for people who are part of our tribe. That's, you know, they took a playbook from nationalists from back in the day about what these words are and what they mean and what they're trying to do. So I think it would be great if they got rid and we stopped pandering to them and if they stopped doing that kind of stuff. But yeah, I do think that this woke nonsense stuff is bad. I have nothing nice to say about
it. So if nationalism is responsible also for Nicole Hannah Jones, there's nothing it can't do, right? It creates empires, it creates wars, it creates Nicole Hannah Jones and wokeism. This is just, again, it has to be so extreme because if you realize it gives just a little bit and he's given away the debate. And on the central point, civic nationalism, we should feel loyalty to our nation and its institutions. He has to call it a different word.
Why didn't you define the Latin root of nationalism like you did for patriotism? Why didn't you do that?
Well,
it gives the game away?
No, because all entities. So you know what else is ethnic-based? Tribes. Tribes are ethnic-based. Sects are ethnic-based. The point that, and all right, do we really want to go to the Azir Ghat section of this debate, you know, the scholar he's referring to? I have this book in my bag here, and the point he's making that you distorted in your writing about this is not that nations are inherently ethnic-based. It's every political entity at the beginning, going back to time, was ethnic-based because we started as tribes. And what you do, you want to build up from that and get higher than that with a nation. So you dissolve tribal loyalties, you dissolve sectarian loyalties, so you all feel a sense of commonality, right? We might not agree on a lot of stuff, we might speak with different accents, I'm a conservative, you're a progressive, but there's something that unifies us really deeply in this country. And at this time, when there's so much division, that's really important, and we shouldn't be turning it away based on strange word games.
It's funny, when I wrote about Azir Ghat's work and I said, I think the United States is an exception to this nationalist project, he actually wrote me a very angry email claiming that there's an ethnic core in the United States that is what defines nationalism here. So I think I understood his work just fine.
Next question.
So my question is actually for the negative, which you in your speech, you say how America is founded on like democratic ideals, like our national identity.
A little bit more to the mic, or, yes, yeah. More to the mic, yeah.
Like national identity and our founding was democratic ideals. But then you go on to say that nationalism is sort of a fervor or love for such national ideals. So then wouldn't American nationalism be fervor and love for our national ideals of democracy and freedom and not love for like sadism or other ideologies that aren't represented within our national identity?
I don't really understand the question, and I don't think I said what you said I said.
Well, I want to clarify your question. So, go ahead, clarify your question.
What I'm saying is that, our nation, as you said, was like an ideological nation, sort of how it was founded on sort of ideas.
No, he's saying it's not a nation at all. He's not saying it's an ideological nation. It's not a nation. You can't use the word.
It's a country. It's a state.
Yeah,
but we're not a nation.
You can't use the N-word
by definition.
It has to be something else. It has to be something else, whatever you call it.
Okay, guys, you started on some interesting... Yeah,
okay, so regardless, our country, nation, was founded on sort of ideological principles, which are like democracy, freedom. That's what you have said. And then you've also said nationalism is sort of like a fervor for sort of like national identity, whether it's like conquering or other stuff. But the difference is that American national identity is more so freedom than it is statism as it is in other places. So,
Then do you understand the question now?
The common unintended consequences of nationalism around the world and frequently by American nationalist politicians are the ones that I laid out in my points. So,
question.
So, just real quick question. Would you support the word countryism?
Sure. What's the Latin root of the word country? What does it mean?
So you're in favor of countryism. It's all the same thing. Civic nationalism is just going to call it a different word.
I don't.
Let's have an agreement. We'll call it civic countryism.
We'll
okay?
call
and
it.
And then everyone can favor it.
We can call it patriotism if you want. But using a word that has a specific meaning that's nasty, that's used by people overseas, that is not consistent with our traditions in this country, is based on an ethnic identifier, is not American.
Alexander Hamilton was un-American? Was he not a nationalist?
A lot of people today call him, a lot of American historians call him an economic nationalist. He wanted a powerful state, a centralized bureaucracy, a large government. But did he want to create an ethnic identity?
He was un-American.
I disagree with his conception of what the United States should be. I don't think he was un-American.
So nationalist
Did he want to create an American ethnic state?
Nationalists can be admirable.
I just said that under the definition of the word nationalist, he is not a nationalist in the European or in the real definition of the word. We're Americans.
We're not Europeans. I mean, that's part of the point.
Yeah, so the word is pretty...
Okay, next question.
But they're wrong. So why use the Latin root of patriotism again? That funny foreign word from Europe?
Nationalism is the same thing. I keep coming back to this.
You always obscure this in your talks. You're like, oh, patriotism is bad. I'm going to use the Latin word. Why don't you ever talk about nationalism and the origins of it and what it means? Do you have Anthony Smith's book in your bag?
I never said patriotism was bad. When did I say that?
Okay, let's understand.
Yeah.
Guys.
You denigrate civic nationalism in your book.
I do not denigrate it. I say
you
that
actually came a long way in your talk.
There are other parts of it. But Hamilton was a nationalist and was not un-American or threatening.
Hamilton was a nationalist.
He was a statist, but he was not a nationalist.
Alex, this is a question for you. In the very beginning of your presentation, you acknowledged that Richard had articulated a coherent form of nationalism. You said it was benign. You didn't say that he's misusing the word nationalism in his definition. So you seem to acknowledge that there are more than one sense of the word nationalism. And also, the way you defined classical liberalism in the American tradition seemed to presuppose the version of nationalism that Richard has discussed in his book. So would you be okay with saying, or would you agree with saying, that classical liberalism in the American tradition presupposes a form of nationalism, namely the version that Richard has articulated in his book?
I mean, my main problem with the definition in Rich's book is that it bears no relationship to how nationalism actually exists. If what he describes nationalism actually is, if that was accurate, we wouldn't be here today. You take a look at surveys of nationalists, you take a look at how nationalist politicians behave and how they act. What he's talking about is theoretical. So if that is the way that it was, we wouldn't be having this debate. But that these are the real-world effects that we're talking about.
Next question.
Okay, I guess this is for Mr. O'Leary. In Ukraine today, there are many people of Russian nationality who speak Russian. The Russian nation state does not incorporate those people. So would you say that the Russian nation state is justified to annex all Russians, especially when they're a big majority, as they are in Crimea and eastern Ukraine? On the other hand, the Ukrainian state has this alien element within it. Does it have the right to expel them or to transform them, to make them into little Ukrainians by taking their children in the public schools and beating Ukrainian into them? And taking away their heritage?
I think the answers are no and no. Putin's vision of Ukraine having no national legitimacy is completely cracked. Now, life being what it is and reality being what it is, complicated and messy, there are areas, you know, where he has more of a case than others. I think Crimea is the prime example. As a prudential, practical matter, would I want the Ukrainians to take back Crimea and provoke a potentially massive reaction for what seems to be not a huge strategic prize? I would say no. But Russian speakers now in the eastern part of Ukraine want no part of Russia, no part of Russia. And the Ukrainian government, again, you know, governments are inherently flawed. I by no means would support everything they have done or will do. Just the basic idea, though, again, they're Ukrainians. They have this place called Ukraine. The borders had been set for quite some time. They should be allowed to govern there and govern it and make their own choices. And look, you know, self-governing nations. They make mistakes, right? Governments, again, are flawed. Human beings are flawed. Everything's flawed. Things are abused. Even the word patriotism is abused and become chauvinism, right? Which fades into militarism. So nothing is perfect. But Putin does not have a right to just, and he wanted to take over, he didn't want just, you know, to secure Crimea. He wanted to take over the entire country and kill its leaders.
I'll come to you, Alex, on the question. No? Okay. Next question. I'm afraid that's going to have to be the final question of the evening, but go ahead with your question.
Yes, this is primarily for Mr. Lowry. In your opening remarks, you talked about the tribal system of Afghanistan not quite rising to the level of a nation, whereas something like the Austro-Hungarian Empire would be supranational. My question is, how can we support nationalism as a justification for a state and the associated minimum requisite coercion, a monopoly on violence, when there's always a way to subdivide what a particular nation, and you know, we can craft something of a national identity for these groups that want to break off?
Yeah, again, they're fuzzy areas. Life is complicated. You know, should Quebec be part of Canada? Right? Has a distinct culture, speaks a different language. This has been a hugely contentious question. In Canada, resolved, you know, mostly peacefully, but so there are always edge cases. But more or less, we know what these distinct peoples are and distinct cultures are. And even, you know, if the ball could have bounced a different way 300 years ago, the basic nationalist idea, buttressing our international order, we got the borders now and honor them. They are sacrosanct. It is wrong. It's an offense to cross someone else's border and try to take that territory. I think that's a really important one, and it stood us in good stead the last 50 years.
Come with you, Alex, on that.
And by magic, once a nationalist starts to cross a line and take another nation's territory, they're suddenly not a nationalist anymore, magically, somehow, through some sort of transformation, is basically the message that I'm getting from all this.
Okay, you both gentlemen are going to come to our after party, so those of you who didn't get to ask a question during the Q&A will be able to buttonhole them. They're both very approachable guys, eager to talk about their particular issues.
Not anymore, okay. Not after this debate.
I'm still very approachable.
Yes. We now go to the summary portion of the evening. 5 minutes for you to summarize. Take it away, Rich.
Wow, so this exceeded my expectations for this debate. No, this has been marvelous. Alex, seriously, we got spirited there. Appreciate you, appreciate your passion, appreciate your intelligence. And debates like this, they're just so important, right? I mean, someone should be doing the equivalent of this on a campus every night to teach people, you can disagree, you can talk over each other a little bit, but then you can go have a drink afterwards and you can learn from one another. You can sharpen your arguments even if you're not going to change your mind, and I'm not. So just let me make my. I do regret now. I dropped out of Latin, you know, in the seventh grade. I really should have stuck with it. I sometimes think that, but then I'm like, no, like the process of learning Latin was not great. So all right, so let's go to another one of these nasty nationalists, John Stuart Mill, you know, a figure at the center of the classical liberal tradition. And I think he put it pretty well. You know what I'm trying to get at tonight. This is what he wrote. A portion of mankind may be said to constitute a nationality if they are united among themselves by common sympathies which do not exist between them and any others, which makes them cooperate each other more willingly than other people, desire to be under the same government, and desire that it should be government by themselves or a portion of themselves exclusively. Again, it gets complicated in the real world, but that's the basic idea. It's a fundamentally correct idea. So here we have this wondrous nation, this bountiful land, this diverse and surprising people of ours, these enduring self-governing institutions, institutions of self-government that should have stood us in such good stead. And we're supposed to say, no, we can't feel an abiding loyalty to this nation and its institutions and want to foster these commonalities for what, right? Because Trump said something idiotic? Because of Adolf Hitler, when Democratic nationalists opposed and fought tooth and nail Adolf Hitler. So I would just submit to you, you can be right, You can be left. You can be a Trotskyite syndicalist. I'm downtown, so I just got to cover my bases. You can be in between, and you should still value this nation, care about the interests of its people. So I would urge you to vote with Washington and Hamilton, with John Quincy Adams and Lincoln, with JFK and Reagan. Vote to support a commonsensical idea that is a foundation of our national life together. Vote not to lose everything that keeps us caring about one another and feeling a sense of community at this time of toxic political debate. Honor all those men and women, some known, some famous, most not known, who cared so deeply about this nation and made so many sacrifices to build it. So, in short, please do the right thing and vote yes on this resolution. Thank you very much.
Well, yeah, thank you, Rich. This was a ton of fun. I learned a lot. I think the audience learned a lot. They probably learned a lot more Latin than they were counting on. Sorry about that. The test on the third declension will be later on at the party. There's a reason why so many people associate nationalism with so many bad outcomes around the world, of the ones that I listed. And that's because the common, often unintended, but the common consequences of nationalism are the consequences that I listed. Big governments, centralized power, central planning of culture, state control over the economy, militarism, war, and often ethnocentric policies that lead to very bad outcomes. Part of our nature, though, I think, is a nationalist impulse. I think this is part of it. For 90% of our history or so, we grew up in small tribes in the wilderness, killing each other. About the murder rate was about 1% per year of adult men. It was terrible. And you can understand in situations like that, when we were primitive, why these types of things, these nationalism, identity would evolve. But as we have a civilization, the extent to which we flourish and are prosperous and are free is to the extent which we build walls around, build institutional and cultural walls around our really bad instincts. We replaced a lot of mysticism with science, with improvements, some bad things, of course, but some, you know, largely improvements. We replaced our communal spirits with capitalism, which has been a tremendous improvement. And I think to the extent that we not replace, but maybe channel these feelings of nationalism, channel this type of ethnic solidarity and feelings of belonging away from the government and toward other avenues, we can build a wall around a lot of our really bad and primitive natures. I guess I'm sounding a little like Edmund Burke right here a little bit. But there are lots of states around the world that are not nation states, that are countries that are free, that are prosperous. Switzerland, Canada, Australia, the United States, and yes, and New Zealand. So these are all fine countries. These are all fine places to live. They're free. I'm a proud citizen of one of them, but I don't think that they fall into the category of a nation. We need to consider the downsides of these. We need to consider the downsides of nationalism and compare it to the upsides. What are the upsides that you heard tonight? A bunch of feelings. Feelings are awesome. I love feelings. Got a big heart. You wouldn't know it looking at me, but I got a big heart, I promise. Even as a libertarian, I got a big heart. But we should keep feelings and government separated like we keep church and state separated. I love my country because it's lovable. I don't love my country because I was born here or I'm part of some kind of tribe. The United States really is an uncommon kind of country in the world. It is very, very special. We're not based on some kind of ancient tribal ideal or some mysticism about how Vercingetorix slaughtered or got executed here or there or all this other sort of mysticism and nonsense. We're a country that welcomes people from around the world, no matter where they're from. They mold together. They become Americans. This is a great country, and this stands athwart, this stands opposed to, and this does not represent a national ideal or nationalism. Lowry quoted very nicely the John Stuart Mill's definition of nationalism. A portion of mankind may be said to constitute a nationality if they're united amongst themselves by common sympathies, which do not exist between them and any others, which make them cooperate with each other more willingly than with other people, desire to be under the same government, and desire that it should be government by themselves or a portion of themselves. Unfortunately, he stopped quoting there. Mill then lists many collinear causes of common national sentiment, beginning with, of course, the effect of ethnicity and race. I'm going to end with a George Orwell quote. George Orwell wrote, quote, "The purpose of nationalism of the nationalist is to secure more power and more prestige, not for himself, but for the nation or other unit in which he has chosen to sink his own individuality." I ask you all to please vote no, and don't sink your own individuality into this abstraction called the nation. Thank you.
So, Jane, please open the vote for the final vote. Nationalism is an important value that that Americans should support. Yes, no, or undecided on the resolution. And while you're considering your vote, I want to make an announcement about next year. That's January. January 26th. We will have a debate on the Federal Reserve. George Mason University Professor of Economics Lawrence White will defend the resolution replacing the Federal Reserve with free market institutions would significantly improve the economy's money, banking, and financial systems against Columbia University Professor of Banking and Financial Institutions Lawrence Mishkin. That's Thursday, January 26th. Go on our website and tickets will be available. But I also want to make a special announcement about the new venture of the SO Forum, which is going to tie in to that January 6th debate. We're calling it the SOHO Forum's Bastiat Society Salon. And we're using the term Bastiat Society because, as many of you know, the Bastiat Societies are flourishing organization that run discussion groups around the country. Our new venture is going to be the SO Forum's version of it. We're going to discuss each debate. We're going to have Monday morning quarterbacking, a postmortem on each debate. The first meeting of the SO Forum's Bastiat Society Salon will take place on Sunday afternoon, January 29th, a few days after that debate on the 26th, from 2 to 4 p.m. Prior to that, an hour and a half prior to that, I'm going to show the debate on video because the discussion will be held at our loft apartment at 55 Great Jones Street, where our after party is going to be. Economist Larry White, who will be defending that resolution, will come to that particular discussion on the 29th to answer questions among the discussants. We're going to limit the membership to 50 people. I initially sent out solicitation to our donors, to our volunteers, and to our special SO Forum Facebook, but now I'm announcing it to all of you, and we will soon have a release about that particular debate and the opportunity for you to buy tickets to that salon. It's going to be $9 for students, $15 for everybody else. We just want you to pay a token amount. Bring your own beer or drinks. Refreshments will be provided. So I would like to make that a monthly event following each debate, and hopefully getting a debater to come. But even if we don't get the debater to come, we can discuss the debate among ourselves and clarify the issues. Unfortunately, this is the last debate we're going to have without a salon, but we'll have our big salon at our home shortly, which both of our debaters will attend. How are we doing on the voting, Jane? Still a little bit of time? Yeah. Good. While the debate, the voting is continuing, I want to make just another announcement that we are, again, taking our show on the road this coming June, for the third year in a row, we will be going up to the Porcupine Freedom Festival in Lancaster, New Hampshire. It's almost also often called Porkfest, but of course that's just short for porcupine, not for pigs. Jane, are you? I'm going to be doing a debate up at the Porcupine Freedom Festival. Go on the website to buy tickets to it because it does tend to be sold out. That's going to be in Lancaster, New Hampshire. We will be up there at the Porcupine Festival. Jane, drum roll, please. Okay, the yes vote for the resolution went from 38.9 to 41.7%. It picked up nearly 3 percentage points. Congratulations, Rich Lowry.
That's landslide.
What? I'm sorry. That's the number to beat. The no vote went from 22.93 to 44.4. It picked up 18 votes. So the no vote wins the Tootsie Roll. But congratulations to you both. Bye-bye.